And let me just say another word about the question. You know, the question period is so important, and it's very important to me. And I want to let you know, some of you already do this, but on our Priests for Life website, we have a page, and it's simply priestsforlife.org/questions. Anytime you have a question, including those that we didn't have time to ask publicly here, my staff is ready to help you with any and every kind of question on pro-life issues. And I want you to think of us as always available to you for that. Even though I have my staff answering the questions, they don't answer with any material that I haven't told them is the appropriate answer to the question. So, and they'll come to me if there's something that I have not spoken to them about at all. So priestforlife.org/questions, and you can send us any time of the year anything that we might be able to help you with. All right. Now, I never considered myself a political expert or even particularly versed in the whole world of politics, because it's messy, it's confusing, it's frustrating, and really it turns a lot of people off. A lot of other people, it scares, and it certainly divides. And yet, the privilege, the opportunity to be able to organize ourselves politically is regarded as a blessing of God. It's an aspect of freedom. In fact, it's an aspect of the dignity of the human person to be able to choose our own leaders. If you look at what our founding fathers did, they incorporated into the structure of this government the teachings of the gospel about the dignity of the human person. Because they engineered a revolution in order to counteract what? Well, if you ask a lot of our grade school students, based on the kind of textbooks that they study in school, the answer they'll give you is what? Why did the revolution occur?
Taxation.
Taxation without representation. That's only one of dozens of reasons why these brave men engineered a revolution. That's a fraction of the reason. The fundamental reason was human rights. The right of the human person to life, to liberty, to the pursuit of happiness. It is no exaggeration to say that this country was founded on the right to life, on an assertion of the right to life. What were they breaking away from? They were breaking away from the idea that the individual citizen or groups of citizens could be, that their rights, that their dignity could be subsumed under some absolute authority other than God. Think about this with me for a moment. Could there be a king? Could there be a prince, a governor, a president? Could there be any human individual who has the ultimate veto power over human rights? Well, sadly, they experienced a situation where there was. And so they said, we have to get out of this oppression where a king has the final word. Or maybe not just the king, but a parliament, a body, a legislative body. Maybe it's 100 people. Maybe it's like in our system, 535 people. Maybe it's a court. Maybe it's an oligarchy. Maybe it's 9 people who have the ultimate say over what kind of rights we have. 9 people who maybe have the ultimate say over whether we live or die, or whether we can worship God the way we believe is right, or whether how many children we can have, or where we send them to school. Who has ultimately these rights over us? This is what our founders were concerned about. That a system of government could in fact recognize the right, the ability, the dignity of the citizens to be able to set their own destiny and to have in their hands the ability to defend their own rights. And that's why they set up a system of government which is actually based on the biblical truth of original sin. What do I mean? Well, why is it that no, at least, now I'm talking about the conception of the founders, all right? We can talk about how the political reality has deviated from that, but in the conception of the founders, is there any one branch of government that has absolute power over us? And the answer is no. Anything that the president is empowered to do is supposed to be counteractable, if there is such a word, all right? It's supposed to be counteractable by the other branches of government. And so Congress can override a veto. An act of Congress is supposed to be undoable by other branches of government. So the president can veto an act of Congress. But the Supreme, what the Congress and the president do together, there still should not be absolute power there. And the Supreme Court can rule certain actions as unconstitutional. How about when the Supreme Court does something? Can the other branches of government do something about it? Well, in the mind of the founders, the answer is yes. And you read it right there in the Constitution that the Congress can take certain issues out of the jurisdiction of the court. And we hardly ever hear about this, do we? But the Congress could say, the right to life is so fundamental that the Supreme Court may not decide cases involving any chance that the right to life would be infringed. They could do that. I think they need to do that. But again, we're not in a political climate and we don't have the kind of votes in Congress right now for them to do that. That doesn't mean they don't have the authority. They do have the authority. And certain issues should be taken out of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and settled once and for all by a constitutional amendment. Now that's what our bishops have stated over and over again. The Pastoral Plan for Pro-Life Activities and various other statements on the anniversaries of Roe v. Wade have reiterated this, that in fact the final legislative slash political goal of our movement is in fact a constitutional amendment. Now, that doesn't mean, brothers and sisters, make a distinction in your mind. What we're defining here is the final legislative goal. We're not saying that that one aspect of it is the entire solution to the abortion problem. No, because we've talked already about the conversion of minds and hearts, about prayer, about the spiritual dimension, and we haven't even had time today to talk about the whole dimension of healing and what's going on in that arena. And I spoke last night about a dozen different reasons why the pro-life movement is winning. So this is we're just talking about this from one dimension here, which is where do we want to end up? Do we want to end up just with a Supreme Court decision? Do we want to end up just with a law of Congress? Do we want to end up with an act of the president or an executive order? Or do we want to end up with an amendment to the Constitution? And because that is the most final sort of a settlement you can have under our American system of government, that in fact is what the church points to as, in America, our ultimate legislative goal. But because it's the most final way to resolve a problem, it's also the most difficult to achieve. You need the Congress, you need the state legislatures to get behind this in a major way, and it's going to take some time. But we are moving in that direction. Now, this goes back to what I said about what the founders had in mind about our human dignity. The fact that we can vote, the fact that the different branches of government can counteract the other branches, is a sign both of our dignity and of our sinfulness, because the founders said, unless we have checks and balances, unless we have one branch of government able to protect us against infringements or violations that another branch might be guilty of, then we're not preserving our dignity. So we have to, because we realize that people are sinful and that power corrupts. So we have to build in checks and balances against what? Against the tendencies of original sin. Our founders were people versed in Scripture. Some of them were Bible translators. Many of them had seminary educations. Some of them wrote Christian hymnals. These were religious men. These were men who understood that the experiment that they were undertaking in self-governance could not possibly work unless the people were rooted in morality and religion. Because if you're asking and expecting a people to govern themselves, what does that mean? It means they have to be able to tell what's good for themselves and what's not.
And if you don't know the difference between right and wrong, you can't govern yourself. You're going to end up deciding things as a majority. If a majority is deceived about the limits of human rights, the boundaries of human rights, or the source of human rights, if a people is deceived about that, and a majority of the people make the wrong choice, how are the people to be protected? So, George Washington, our first president, some of the first members of the Supreme Court, they made these assertions very explicitly that without religion and morality, this experiment in governance will not succeed. Now, they asserted that very, very strongly and said, therefore, that the human rights that we possess, which is the basis for our self-governance, now the voice of each individual is no longer absorbed under the rule of a king, but it's expressed in the active participation of those people in a system of representative government. Now, that has to be recognized, those rights have to be recognized as coming from God. And so again, we see our founding fathers, and I want to recommend a book to you, called Original Intent. If you're interested in delving into this, these points I've been making now more deeply and really understanding what our founders said about all of this, the relationship between law and religion and human rights and God and the Constitution and the courts, the book you want to read is Original Intent by a man by the name of David Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N. We distribute this book through Priests for Life. And do we have, by the way, let me divert to a practical matter here. Do we have those yellow cards? Have they been distributed or are they available at the back on the table? Donetta, yes. The yellow cards I want to be distributed because some of the things I've mentioned or will mention, if you want us to send you materials directly like this book I just mentioned, all you need to do is fill out these yellow cards, which I'll take home with me, and I'll put my staff to work on Monday morning answering your requests and sending you these books and all this other stuff. Okay, Original Intent. Here's what Barton says in Original Intent. Our founders did not establish a democracy. And you say that to some of our fellow citizens, and they're going to say, what? What do you mean they didn't establish a democracy? I thought I was living in a democracy. The actual meaning of the word democracy is that the majority opinion rules. And so that no matter what the majority of people say is right, it's right and it's allowed. So what if a majority of people, by some strange twist of circumstance, were to say that murder is okay? Would it be okay? Well, in the mind of our founding fathers, it would still not be okay. Why? Because human law cannot contradict divine law. Oh, but that's church and state. Well, no. In the minds of our founders, they were together. The state had to be based on divine law. That doesn't mean the state embraces a particular religion. It means its people are free to embrace the religion they want. But it means that the state cannot survive unless it recognizes God and the law of God. The laws of God, particularly starting with the human rights that He gives us. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. You cannot kill, you cannot imprison, you cannot impede the growth of people and the progress of people towards a world of better security, justice, peace, and love. Our founding fathers were convinced, therefore, that democracy was not the way to go, but rather a representative republic in which, yes, the people would govern themselves, yes, their leaders would be elected by majority votes, but at the same time that the lawmakers understood that no human law was valid if it contradicted divine law. It was not valid. Notice what we're saying. A Supreme Court ruling like Roe v. Wade that permits the killing of innocent human beings is not simply a bad decision. It's not simply bad law. What does the church teach? It is no law at all. It is not a valid act of the court. Is Roe versus Wade a valid exercise of Supreme Court authority? The church says, no, it's not. Going back to the Declaration of the Apostles, when they were told not to preach in the name of Jesus. What did they say? They said to the authorities of their day, judge for yourselves whether it is right for us to obey you rather than God. Our founding fathers acknowledged the distinction between human law and divine law. Now, the fact that human law has to correspond to divine law is not the same thing as saying that we want a theocracy. Some of the folks on the other side of these issues will accuse us precisely of that. In fact, when I started speaking out about political responsibility and Priests for Life began being very vocal in the elections of 2000, I was at the National Press Club one day for one of our press conferences, and you know what the media accused me of? They said, Father Frank is calling for a Vatican takeover of America. And my response was, I am not calling for any Vatican takeover of America. I am calling for an American takeover of America. Because what Roe versus Wade did was to establish a different kind of government. Literally, it is no exaggeration to say that with the Roe versus Wade Supreme Court decision, the court was asserting that we had a different kind of government than we actually have. What do I mean? What I mean is that the Declaration of Independence says human rights come from God, starting with life, and that governments, I'm quoting the Declaration, governments are instituted among men to do what? Well, just before that phrase, it says, to secure these rights. Secure! Not bestow. Not grant. Not bargain. Not sell. Not edit, delete, or take away, or diminish, or dilute. But to secure. That's the role, and that's the limit of the role of government in relation to human rights, starting with life. So if our founders thought that the right to life could not be touched by a king, a Congress, a president, or a court, or even by the majority of the people, by what authority? By what imagined authority? Does our Supreme Court suddenly declare a whole category of human beings to be non-persons? The fact of the matter is, it doesn't have that authority, which goes back to what I said a moment ago, that Roe v. Wade is not a legitimate, valid juridical act. It isn't. The Supreme Court overstepped its bounds. So when our friends on the other side say the government shouldn't be involved in such a personal private decision as abortion, the government's too involved in the abortion issue. Shouldn't be a political debate. I say to them, you know, you really don't realize how right you are. The government got too involved in abortion when it legalized it. That's when it overstepped its bounds and got way too involved because it presumed to be able to take away the right to life. Government can't do that. It can't do that. It's above its pay grade to take away the right to life. Way above. I ought to say that a few times publicly in the next 8 weeks, don't you think? Yeah. Brothers and sisters, there are only two forms of government, ultimately. The one that says, as our founders said, that human rights come from God and governments have to protect those rights. The other kind is the kind that says that government gives and can take away human rights. And those are tyrannical states. Those are the kind of regimes that oppress their people and create holocausts in human history, staining the story of the human family. And there's no in-between. When, therefore, a political candidate expresses his or her view of Roe versus Wade, that individual is not simply expressing what they think about the legality of a medical procedure. That person is expressing their view of what kind of government we have. That person is expressing their view of what kind of power they think we give them when we put them in office. And the fact is that if they think they have power over human life and death and over human rights, they're wrong. They never had it,
And in fact, we can't give it to them even if we wanted to. And our founders certainly did not intend to give it to them by drafting either the Declaration or the Constitution. Now, having laid that foundation, I refer you to this beautiful document, Living the Gospel of Life. In 1995, Pope John Paul II issued the Gospel of Life, the encyclical which in many ways is a Magna Carta for the pro-life movement. 3 years later, in 1998, 10 years ago, the United States bishops as a body took the Gospel of Life and created this document to apply its teachings to the specific American situation. And this is how the church works. At the worldwide level, various Vatican agencies or the Pope himself issue various documents, and then the episcopal conferences of each country are meant to apply those teachings, and so they come up with documents of their own. That do not add any new teaching, but that apply the teaching to the circumstances in their country. That's what this document does. It's much shorter than the Gospel of Life. This printed version that you see in my hands is 25 pages long. It's a very readable document. Archbishop Charles Chaput of Denver just came out with his book called Render Unto Caesar. And I highly recommend his book. At the beginning of his book, he says that the clearest, the best, the most forceful, the most direct statement that the United States Catholic bishops ever made on it matters of political responsibility is living the Gospel of Life. And he says that if my book leads people back to this document, it will have achieved one of its purposes. I cannot, when we at Priest for Life teach about political responsibility, this is our key source, and this is what we recommend to people all over the country. We'll be in another 2 weeks at the National Press Club again, and we will be speaking to the national media again about this document, urging people, Catholics and non-Catholics alike, to read it, to study it. And we've created a study guide to this document that can be used in parishes. Now, this document begins by talking about the things I've already been talking to you about. What did our founders have in mind? How did they see human rights in relationship to government? And why is Roe versus Wade an invalid act of government? The bishops state this clearly in this document. And then they go on to a practical application. Elections. If, in fact, we have a system of self-governance, it becomes both a blessing and a responsibility to take part in it by registering and voting in an informed way, and understanding the kinds of issues on which we have to evaluate the candidates. And let me read, by way of really summarizing one of the key assertions of this document, this paragraph 23, in which the bishops say this about the kinds of issues at stake in an election. Adopting a consistent ethic of life, the Catholic Church promotes a broad spectrum of issues, seeking to protect human life and promote human dignity from the inception of life to its final moment. Opposition to abortion and euthanasia does not excuse indifference to those who suffer from poverty, violence, and injustice. Any politics of human life must work to resist the violence of war and the scandal of capital punishment. Any politics of human dignity must seriously address issues of racism, poverty, hunger, employment, education, housing, and health care. Catholics should eagerly involve themselves as advocates for the weak and marginalized in all these areas. Catholic public officials are obliged to address each of these issues as they build consistent policies which promote respect for the human person at all stages of life. Then the next sentence in the original is in italics, and it says, "But being right in such matters can never excuse a wrong choice regarding direct attacks on innocent human life." What are they saying? There are all kinds of attacks on human life. There are all kinds of threats to human dignity. Some are direct. Others are indirect. Some have to do with policy. Others have to do with the principles underlying the policy. Example, must we confront and eradicate poverty? Yes. Is that a Catholic principle? Well, yes, because it's based on the dignity of the poor and the responsibility of people towards their neighbors. Okay, so then what's the Catholic policy to eradicate poverty? Well, what do you mean? Well, to be a good Catholic, what kind of anti-poverty program or policy do you have to adopt? Well, there are dozens of them. There are all kinds of policies and programs. Each one has to be evaluated. Yeah, but which one is more Catholic? Well, the Church doesn't say there's one that's more Catholic than the other. The Church says the principle is the sacred dignity of the poor, their right to things like housing and employment and education and health care, the duty of solidarity that we have with the poor, the responsibility of government. Okay, but then what do we do specifically? Well, the Church says the lawmakers and the citizens working with them have to figure that out. Yeah, but what's the most Catholic? Well, you figure it out. Well, different parties and different candidates have different platforms and different proposals. Yeah, let may the best man win. Propose your case, trial and error, try it out, make your case, do the statistics, measure the results, and then change what has to be changed. Isn't this what we do? Try to eradicate poverty with some kind of magic wand or simple formula, you can be sure that the Church would be trumpeting it from the housetops. But we don't have any magic formula or magic wand. Anti-crime, same thing. How do we reduce crime in our neighborhoods? I don't know. I mean, you try any number of different things. It ties in with education. It ties in with law enforcement. It ties in with the kind of laws you have in the first place. But what's the Catholic way to do it? Well, there isn't a specifically Catholic policy. There are Catholic principles. There are suggestions here and there. And the bishops might even write a statement here or there to recommend a particular proposal. They're not recommending it as doctrine. They're recommending it as, hey, we're part of the political process too, so why don't you try out these ideas? But we're fallible like all the rest of you, and we don't know, but let's try it. Perfectly legitimate because the Church is a part of the process of public policy. But you see what I'm saying? That particular programs and policies, platforms and proposals, are one thing. Where they try to implement the underlying principle. Is the debate in our culture a debate between fighting crime and the right to crime? Is that the debate? I mean, when candidates in this coming election season, at whatever level of government, get up to have their debates, are we going to hear any candidate advocate for the right to commit crime? I mean, I haven't heard of one, have you? That's not under dispute. It's not, there's no such thing as a right to crime. What they're going to be arguing about is what? Well, your particular policy, sir, has utterly failed. And the other one is going to argue back, yeah, but yours isn't even better. We're trying some new ideas. Yeah, but your ideas are going to fail for the same reason the old ones did. Yeah, well, and to go back and forth. Well, that's a good kind of debate. At least they both agree that crime should be reduced. I mean, do we have people lobbying for more poverty? The right to poverty, yeah. I mean, that we should really promote it. We should have more. Now, people are not going to get up on the podiums or in front of the news microphones saying, listen, I've got a great plan for more poverty. There's an underlying principle that we really do agree on. That, you know what? We kind of got to help the poor somehow. The arguments are going to be, your program and policy has failed the poor. No, yours has failed the poor. Okay. That's a legitimate debate. Now, when it comes to the right to life, brothers and sisters, the policy is the principle. Understand what I'm saying? There is no policy disagreement about how best to implement the principle. The disagreement is on the principle itself. Do human beings have an absolute right to life or not? And some are saying right to choose. That is, to choose abortion. What does that mean? The killing of a child. Is the argument, well, what kind of policy should we have? about how we kill the child. What kind of policy should we have? No, the policy is the principle. Either you have a policy that is allowed or a policy that is not allowed. When the policy is the principle, you're not talking about a multiplicity of Catholic views. You're talking about a fundamental choice between what is always wrong and what is always right. And that's why, this is what the bishops are trying to say here, that direct attacks on innocent human life go deeper than policy disagreements about health care, education, housing, or anti-crime proposals. This is not to say that those other issues aren't important. What we're saying is that they are. But that everything that is an issue is based on a principle. And at the basis of all the issues is the principle of the sacredness and dignity and rights of the human being. And so the bishops go on to say, the failure to protect and defend life in its most vulnerable stages renders suspect any claims to the rightness of positions in other matters. And then they quote John Paul II, saying that the common outcry which is made on behalf of human rights is false and illusory if the right to life is not defended. Think of it this way, and I've used this example many times. Imagine a candidate stands up and says, I support terrorism. I think the terrorists have a right to do what they did. Do you really think voters are going to say, well, sir, I disagree with you on terrorism, but what's your health care plan? Or are voters going to say, you know what? I don't even care what your health care plan is. You might have the best health care plan in the world, and that doesn't mean that I'm not concerned about health care, but you're disqualified from public office. We just can't have somebody in office who thinks that terrorism is okay. Or somebody comes along and says, I'm a racist. I believe we should go back to segregation. How many votes is that person going to gain? I think we should go back to segregation. I don't think women should have the right to vote. We made a mistake, and I'm here to tell you that it's time to fix that mistake. Well, sir, I disagree with you about women's votes, but tell me about your education plan, and maybe I'll vote for you. Obviously, some issues are disqualifying issues. Why are so many people blind to the fact that abortion is one of them? Are any of the people who would refuse to vote for a racist, are any of the people who would refuse to vote for a terrorist, are any of the people who would refuse to vote for someone who denied women the right to vote, to be fairly accused of saying the other issues don't matter? That's nothing of what they're saying. What they're saying, are they to be accused of being single-issue people? I'll tell you what the reality is. Most people are motivated into politics because of some single issue. This is the reality. That's how people get involved. Nothing wrong with that. What's wrong is if we're oblivious to all the other issues. There's nothing wrong with being motivated by a single issue. And there's certainly nothing wrong with being able to disqualify a candidate based on a position so egregiously wrong and so contradictory to the public good and to the very meaning of government that it disqualifies a person from participating in public office. As I say it, the first characteristic of a public servant that's required is that they be able to tell the difference between serving the public and killing the public. Or, put another way, if a politician can't respect the life of a little baby, how's he supposed to respect yours? Now, so, quick question. Can the church say that? Must the church say that? Absolutely. For us to think that a declaration like I've just made or a question like I've just asked is somehow too political for the pulpit, our founding fathers would stand up in the congregation and say, preacher, you got to preach that.
That's what we suffered for. That's what we died for. That's what we had a revolution for. This is America. What do you mean you can't say that in the very country in which that revolution bought you the freedom to say that? Our founders would stand up with a quizzical look in their eyes and say, "What kind of country do you think this is?" Must we say this? Of course we must say it. In fact, the church has said it. This document says it. And brothers and sisters, because this document says it, one of the most frequent questions that arises, whether I'm talking to priests or other parish ministers or just ordinary citizens and churchgoers, all these questions about what is it that's appropriate for the church to say? How do we navigate the legal waters between, you know, doing our work as a church and becoming too political? What about the IRS? What about the tax exemption? What about the fears that our priests have? What they can say, what they can't say? There's one very simple solution to all those questions. If the priests preach and teach what's in this document, they're on solid ground. They're on solid ground doctrinally. It's a document of the bishops. And they're on solid ground legally, because you can be sure that not a single syllable of this document was released to the public unless a whole team of attorneys had gone through it with a fine-tooth comb to make sure that the entire United States Conference of Catholic Bishops wasn't going to be hauled before the IRS for making this statement. Now, first of all, you know that bumper sticker that says, "I break for animals"? Some people have made a funny bumper sticker based on that saying, "I break for hallucinations." You ever see that one? Or maybe it's an East Coast thing. Well, we got it out on the East Coast. People have these bumper stickers, "I break for hallucinations." That's what we do sometimes in the church. We break for hallucinations. And sometimes other people are deliberately creating those hallucinations to scare us. I, for one, am not going to be fooled by that. We're going to speak, and we're going to speak loud and clear that preachers have to get into the pulpit, no matter what denomination they belong to, and stop dancing around, and instead say clearly to their people that the right to life is the fundamental duty of government to protect, and that therefore we've got to elect people who are ready to protect it. Not based on, you know, there's a lot of dispute, and you've got it here in Kansas, in a very real way, there's a lot of dispute that's going to be swirling around the question of whether Catholic public officials, how they should be handled for blatantly denying a fundamental tenet of their Catholicism, which is the protection of life. But my friends, the fundamental problem is not that they're contradicting the meaning of their Catholicism. The fundamental problem is that they're contradicting the meaning of public office. And when you put it that way, first of all, it doesn't put you in a position of having to make decisions that only bishops are supposed to make. Secondly, it doesn't put you in the whole church-state controversy. And thirdly, it doesn't let the non-Catholic public officials off the hook. Any and every public official, Christian, Catholic, atheist, no matter who, has an obligation to the meaning of that public office and the very first purpose of government, which, as we already said, and as our founders said, was the protection of these basic human rights. Okay. Very practically then, this is the tool, and there are other documents too. The bishops just issued it was back in November, they issued Forming Consciences for Faithful Citizenship, and there are bulletin inserts. The bishops of Kansas have issued excellent documents along the lines of political responsibility, and there will be more in the coming weeks. The point is, let's use them. Let's quote them in our letters to the editor, on TV and radio programs, in our church bulletins. Let's get the information. And don't presume that because a church issued a document that your pastor has it sitting right there on the top of the pile of papers on his desk. No. Bring it to him again. And say, "Father, as you know, our bishops have issued this document, and could we have this in our bulletin? Could we have this, you know, mention it in the pulpit? Could we distribute it to our parishioners?" You know, a lot of times there's all kinds of disputes. Oh, well, what can we distribute in church? What kind of flyers can we distribute in church? Well, last time I checked, it's kind of okay to distribute in church what the bishops wrote.
I think.
I mean, things are pretty bad if we can, right? I mean, we're really in trouble.
Okay, you've got a tool here to use. Use it. Now, secondly, on a practical, very practical matter, you know what's counted at the end of the day on election day?
It's the votes.
Obvious. But we have to think what that means. What it means is that what's not counted is the amount of money the other side has. They always outspend us. Pro-abortion political action committees, they always outspend us. And yet we keep winning elections. Pro-life people win elections. And they win elections because enough of the public votes on the issue of abortion to sway elections, even if it's not a majority of the people. It's an increment. Elections are won by a few percentage points here or there. So pro-life people really do determine the outcome of our nation's elections. There's no reason to think that this year's elections will be any different from that. So the bottom line is a numbers game. Now, we tend to think in terms of principles, and we want to convert everybody, and we want to, you know, argue with people. Listen, we can argue and try to convert anyone, and we pray for the conversion of everyone. But do it starting November 5th. Between now and then, don't worry about the people who aren't going to listen to you. Don't worry about spending hours on end arguing with Aunt Sally or Cousin Jimmy about who they're going to vote for, because they always vote the wrong way and they can't seem to convince them every time, and you think it might be a good personal victory for yourself to convert them this time. At this time I'm going to do it. Yeah, maybe you will, but that's, first of all, if you do succeed, you only get one vote. If you don't succeed, you spend hours and hours of energy that you could have used for something different, and the something different is to gather the low-hanging fruit. What I mean is the people who already think the way you do, but maybe they forgot to register to vote because they moved since the last election. 25% of the American population move every year. One out of four people that you know is living at a different address than they did last year at this time, which means that they're probably in a different voting district and they got to re-register. The point is, go for the low-hanging fruit. I spoke at Thomas Aquinas College one time in Southern California. They have an orange grove on their property. Itchy oranges growing from the trees. And you walk along and you can pick the oranges. I took a picture of me reaching out my hand to one of the oranges to illustrate this principle. If I had to gather as many oranges as I could in the course of an hour in that orange grove, I wouldn't go climbing to the top of the trees to get the oranges way up there. Waste of time! I'd be using that precious time and energy to run around as fast as I could and get all the ones that are within arm's reach. There are people within your reach. There are people who already agree with you on the issue. Maybe they just need a little nudge, a little reminder. Maybe they need to be reminded to register to vote. Maybe they need a ride to the polls when election time comes. Maybe they need a little bit of information, like the voters' guides that we have here today, on where the candidates stand on the issues. But one way or the other, it is a numbers game in the end. And you know what? What's also not counted on election night is the reason why somebody voted for a particular candidate. So if I know the candidate I want to support, and I want other people to vote for that candidate, I'm not necessarily interested that people vote for that candidate for the right reason or for the same reasons that I'm voting for him. I don't care if they vote for him because they like the color of his tie or the sound of his voice. I want them to vote for him, period. Do everything you possibly can to maximize the number of votes for the candidates you support. And one of the things practically that you can do is to, first of all, make people aware of the deadline for voter registration. Now, voter registration deadlines are going to start popping up in various states in another couple of weeks. And in Kansas, according to this listing, it's October the 20th. Voter registration closes on October the 20th. Okay, that's not that far away. Now, some people only start thinking about the election a week before the election, and if they say, oops, you know, I moved since the last time, I have to register again, they come to find out they're not registered and they can't vote. Don't let that happen to anyone in your parish. Don't let that happen to anyone in your prayer group or Bible study or pro-life organization or other group that you belong to or in any of your circle of influence. Get them registered to vote now. Secondly, early voting. According to this information I have here, Kansas is one of the states that allows No excuse early voting. You familiar with this? Starting on October the 15th, you can vote in this state, right? Starting on October 15th. So when we promote political responsibility in the parishes or in our own circle of influence, we're not talking about election day in this state. We're talking about election season. Election day is not November the 4th. Election day is a big, long day that starts on October 15th and finishes at the end of November 4th. Why is this so important? Well, first of all, there's the obvious reason. I'm going to vote on election day. Oops, I forgot. Oh, I woke up sick and I couldn't get out of bed. Oh, my car broke down. My boss needed me to stay overtime. A million and a half things can go wrong. My nephew from out of state got sick and I had to go see him the night before election day and I couldn't get back before the polls closed. All kinds of things happen that get people to end up missing their vote. So first of all, we want to counteract all of that stuff that can go wrong by voting as early as possible. Secondly, when people are already convinced of who they want to vote for, maybe because you convinced them, voting early keeps the other side from changing their mind. Sometimes people's minds are changed by a single TV or radio ad, or by some stupid, uninformed comment that somebody makes to them that makes them say, oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that. You know, and they end up changing their mind. The point is, thirdly, that it simply gives us more of an opportunity to gather those low-hanging oranges into the basket. So make sure everyone in your parishes, in your prayer groups, everyone anywhere within the range of your influence understands that election day starts on October 15th. You don't have to have a reason not to be at the polls on in some states you have to have a reason. Some states you have to have a reason because you're going to be out of state on election day or other responsibilities prevent you from going to the polls. But here, it's October 15th on. Now, let me finish by giving you the website that we have set up for this election season, politicalresponsibility.com. Political Responsibility is a place where we put up documents like Living the Gospel of Life. It's a place where we put up information like when are the early voting dates in various states and when are the voter registration deadlines. It's a place where we put up various ideas of what we can do to gather the low-hanging fruit. It's a place where we put up voter guides to inform people on the position of the candidates on the various issues. It's a place where you will find these and many more resources. Brothers and sisters, I am confident that the elections of 2008 are going to be a step forward for the culture of life. But we can spare no effort, we cannot relax until we do that, and we need to do it together. Let's not be afraid. Let's inspire our fellow citizens and our leaders not to be afraid, so that together we'll celebrate another step closer to the victory. Another step. Because politics is not our salvation. Jesus is. No candidate, no platform is our substitute for our Savior. But it's precisely our Savior who is calling us to be involved. It's precisely the Lord who gives us the task of changing the political landscape. So let's do it together. Let's do it with joy. And I look forward to coming back and celebrating with you yet another step forward for the protection of our unborn brothers and sisters. Thanks for all you do, and God bless you.